iHeart Podcasts. Guess what, Mango?
What's that, Will?
All right, so when we decided to do today's episode on different dances, I started thinking back to all the dances that we learned as kids and all the songs where every kid in school felt like they had to master the dance move. So when you think about this, what dances come to mind?
So, you know what's strange is I was actually thinking about this recently, and obviously there are moves like the Roger Rabbit or whatever, but I actually kind of feel grateful that we grew up in this era when there weren't a lot of great dances, and at least when we were in middle school, like all the breakdancing and moonwalking was over by then, and then all the songs seemed to be just about jumping. Like House of Pain was Jump Around. Criss Cross had that song Jump.
Yeah,
like,
of course.
Even like dancing to Nirvana was just like bouncing up and down and bumping into each other. And
you
it was
totally right about this. I didn't think about that.
So much easier than like watching what my kids have to go through just to keep up with like the Shoot and the Whip Nene and like practicing how to floss all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, but I, you know, a few others do come to mind for me, and probably two stand out above the others. You know, the first of these was definitely Michael Jackson's Thriller. And I know I've mentioned this before, but my sister was a few years older than me. And so when she was out with friends or still at school, I would often sneak into her room and listen to tapes on that fancy double cassette boombox that she had. And, you know, I might pop in some Duran Duran or the Bangles or any number of other tapes that she had. But my favorite was definitely Michael Jackson's Thriller. And I was terrible at dancing to that song, but it didn't stop me from trying to master it. But, you know, the other dance that comes to mind, and you might argue this one was a little bit easier to master, that was the Electric Slide.
So I remember going into the school dance in like sixth grade, and suddenly everyone was doing the Electric Slide, and I couldn't figure out, like, had I missed a class where this was taught? Because, like, everyone knew how to do it.
Well, it might have felt like everybody mastered it, but my guess is the dance's creator, Richard Silver, he might not agree with that, you know, especially if you weren't doing all 22 proper steps of the dance. Now, this may seem a little bit silly, but he was serious about this. So Silver was this well-known dancer in the New York City disco scene, and he came up with the Electric Slide in 1976. And he was more than a little particular about people doing it just right, especially because there was this version of the dance that caught on that only involved 18 of the 22 steps that he'd choreographed. And he'd get so angry about people doing it wrong that for years he would threaten to sue people who were doing it incorrectly. And
what?
He even convinced YouTube to take down several videos of like weddings and bar mitzvahs and other parties that involve people butchering his creation. Is this not nuts?
That's amazing.
But he finally gave up on trying to police the world on behalf of his dance when this other civil rights organization, they actually sued him on behalf of a man whose party clips had been taken down from the web because of Silver. But anyway, this bizarre incident got us thinking about the unusual and often controversial origins of some of the most well-known dances in history. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So let's dive in. Hey there, podcast listeners. Welcome to Part-Time Genius. I'm Will Pearson, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend Mangesh Hattikader. And on the other side of the soundproof glass, practicing the steps for the official Arch Deluxe line dance. That's our friend and producer, Tristan McNeil. Now, I have to admit, I'd never heard of this, but apparently this dance was part of a McDonald's ad campaign back in the mid-90s. Do you remember this, Mango?
Yeah, the Arch Deluxe. It was a giant failure from what I remember.
Yeah, and I guess the company was trying to attract older customers by introducing what they billed as, quote, the burger with the grown-up taste, which is just such a weird line. And you're right, it sounds like nobody liked it. I don't think the dance fared that much better either. But Tristan actually dug up the steps on the old Arch Deluxe website, which you can apparently still access, and I think everybody should do this because it's just as ridiculous as you might imagine. I mean, listen to some of these dance moves, and they describe them in detail for you here. It says, right arm rolls up and down twice like the wave in an ocean, then step forward and form the golden arches with your arms. I mean, what could be cooler than doing these dance moves? But Unsurprisingly, this did not catch on, and that's despite McDonald's bold claim that, quote, people across America are mixed-stepping to the beat of the newest dance craze.
So I looked into this, and it seems like the whole idea was meant as a way to capitalize on how popular the Macarena was at the time. And the company went all out to try and make this the next big thing. And I read that they actually shuttled a bunch of employees to McDonald's headquarters for Do the Deluxe dance lessons. And then there was a giant pep rally right there after, and the Village People attended and performed for some reason.
What do you mean, for some reason? I mean, they were mixed stepping to the beat, Mango.
Yeah, I mean, nothing gets you more excited than a mandatory pep rally, I'm sure.
Exactly. Well, you know, today's show is about more than burger-inspired dance moves, because for too long now, we've been plagued by some pretty important questions. You know, things like, did Michael Jackson really invent the moonwalk? And why are good ballet shoes so hard to find? And why do we teach kids to square dance in gym class? That's a big one that I feel like we should answer. But today, we're going to hit the dance floor and see if we can finally unravel some of the weird and surprising mysteries of dance. And I feel like I'm going to let you take the lead on this one, Mango. So where should we start?
So you remember that one Gloria Estefan song, The Rhythm's Gonna Get You?
I'm a little insulted that you would ask if I know. The rhythm is gonna get you. Of course I do.
Yeah, so my question is basically why? Like, what is it about watching people dance that makes you want to dance yourself?
It's a good question, and I will also say that that line always sounded a little ominous to me, like something was coming after me.
Anyway. It is going to get you in a very catchy way, but you know, we talk about all kinds of things going viral on the internet now, but dancing in particular has a really long history of being likened to a virus. So you and our listeners have probably heard of that so-called dancing plague that struck Europe in the early 1500s, and this is when hundreds of people started compulsively dancing for days on end without resting. And within a month or so, many of them had collapsed or even died from exhaustion. And today, researchers have all kinds of ideas about what brings on these bizarre forms of mania. Everything from, like, food poisoning to psychosis, but there still are no hard answers. Like, the rhythm simply got them.
Boy, did it. Yeah, I mean, the dance plague is a pretty extreme case. I think about times when you're just watching a performance and you know, you may start to move your shoulders or bobbing your head and just kind of dancing along a little bit in your seat. Like, did you come across any answers for why that happens?
So nothing concrete, but there's a good deal of evidence to suggest that our bodies are attuned to the movements of others because of responses in our brains. So the idea is that whenever we make a certain movement, a corresponding region of the brain is activated. But this is where it gets weird, because that region of the brain is activated not only when we perform the movement ourselves, but when we observe someone else performing it.
So you're saying, like, when we watch somebody dance, our brains are sort of simulating the dance steps internally? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And this unconscious response is actually strong enough in some people that they will actually start to, you know, act out the movements they're internalizing. How heightened your response is depends on how familiar you are with the movements and how much enjoyment you get from making them yourself. So, for example, like the motor regions of a professional dancer's brain will actually become much more active when they watch someone dance compared to someone who doesn't dance themselves.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. But, I mean, there is one form of dance, and that would probably be ballet, that my brain just throws in the towel. Like, those are movements I can't even think through, but much less perform myself. And that's especially true of the moves where the ballerinas are on their toes. And I've always just found this so interesting, and I thought I would look into the background of this. And it turns out ballerinas first started dancing on their toes in the late 1700s, but not in the way that we're used to. At first, the dancers were actually lifted off the stage by this system of wires so that it would appear like they were hovering on their toes. And years later, this system led to the invention of pointe shoes, which were then sturdy enough for the dancers to actually balance on their toes without the aid of these wires.
So I've actually been curious about this. So do pointe shoes have, like, solid wood in the tips, or how are they so hard there?
You know, I always thought that they did, but it turns out they're actually made from layers of fabric and paper that have been hardened, and they harden them with a flour paste. So it's a little bit more like paper mache. And then once that shape is set, the shoes are wrapped in satin, and then the tips are flattened with an actual hammer, and that kind of forms that platform for the dancers to stand on. But you know, the initial process is really just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to modding pointe shoes, because before a ballerina can debut a fresh pair on stage, she first has to spend several hours, you know, cutting and ripping and scraping and crushing and often even burning these shoes in order to make them fit just right.
I mean, that sounds insane, but, you know, why can't shoemakers just make the shoes the way dancers like them from the start?
Well, I was wondering that too, but if you think about it, there's just way too much variation between the shape and size of a dancer's feet for these manufacturers to be able to cover that. And they'd have to specially make these shoes for each and every dancer, which isn't really financially feasible when you consider that some dancers wear out a pair of pointes after a single performance. And
oh, wow.
Many of these dancers may go through over 100 pairs of shoes over the course of a season. So while it's certainly time consuming for the dancers to alter their own shoes, it's probably the most practical solution.
So what kind of benefits do the ballerinas get from these specialized modifications?
Well, it depends. Like, each dancer likes their shoes a little bit different. So the methods, you know, vary based on what they may be looking for. So, for example, some ballerinas cut the soles out of their shoes to improve that flexibility, and then they may super glue them back together again. And others outfit their shoes with a product called ouch pouches, which are basically these silicone gel caps that you know, provide a little extra padding for their toes. And I even read about one ballerina who likes to rip out the sole and lining of her shoes and then mark the spot where her arches are and then break the shoes in half with her hands.
Oh, wow.
From there. But the other thing I thought was really cool about this is that these rituals, they're really passed down from one generation of dancers to the next. So when a ballerina first starts out, she'll often have a more experienced dancer that'll show her the tricks of the trade and kind of help her craft her own.
I mean, that is pretty cool. And I also like how all that labor is sort of representative of ballet as a whole. Like, on the outside, the shoes look polished and flawless, just like the dance moves. But beneath the surface, there's this insane level of hard work and struggle that goes into making them so perfect.
Yeah, that seems like a good way to think about it. And it's often easy to forget just how painful ballet dancing can be because of how graceful the final product looks. But just reading up on points, I mean, I saw that even for all the effort that goes into making the shoes fit perfectly, it still hurts so much when a ballerina dances on the tips of her toes most of the time. And apparently the pain can get so bad that some dancers even soak their feet in alcohol or apply tooth-numbing gel just to make it through a single practice session.
Ah, that's brutal. But, you know, speaking of pain, what do you say we head back to school for a minute and talk about the all-too-familiar pain of being forced to square dance in gym class?
You know, the only thing more painful than dancing in those pointe shoes may be square dancing. And it's such a bizarre practice. And it feels like the kind of thing that's bound to have some really weird story behind it.
Yeah, and it actually does, because while square dancing dates back to colonial America, the modern revival that led to it being taught in schools is actually thanks to none other than Henry Ford.
Seriously, Ford? So what does he have to do with it?
So, I mean, the first thing to know is that Ford despised jazz music and everything related to it. So that's like the flappers, the Charleston, swing dancing. He hated all of it. But that wasn't all that Ford hated. He also hated Jewish people.
Oh, that's right. And he was pretty outspoken with his anti-Semitism, right? Like, didn't he even write a bunch of propaganda pamphlets about it?
That's right. So in the early 1920s, he put out a 4-volume series of booklets called The International Jew. And while I hate to quote from something so baseless and hateful, there's one excerpt of the 3rd volume that really explains Ford's thinking on jazz and why he would be so interested in square dance revival. So here it goes. Ford writes, quote, "Many people have wondered whence came the waves upon waves of musical slush that invade decent homes and set the young people of this generation imitating the drivel of morons. Popular music is a Jewish monopoly. Jazz is a Jewish creation. The mush slush, the sly suggestion, the abandoned sensuousness of sliding notes are all of Jewish origin."
Wait, so Ford really believed that Jewish people invented jazz music? I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he somehow convinced himself that it was all part of a secret plan to corrupt the masses and to get them to take up drinking and smoking and all sorts of other vices that, you know, Ford being a prude disapproved of. But there's at least one form of dancing that Ford and his wife could get behind, and that's what they referred to as, quote, old-fashioned dancing. So this included square dancing, but also other Anglo-Saxon dances like waltzes and quadrilles. And most of the country, including the rural parts, had moved on from old-fashioned dances like this in favor of jazz or swing. But, you know, the Fords thought they could counteract these bad influences by rekindling the country's passion for square dancing. So to that end, Ford poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into square dancing and other forms of country music. And he funded fiddling contests. He paid radio shows to promote old-time dancing music. He started square dancing clubs all over the country. He even made it a requirement for all his employees to attend special square dancing events that he organized for them.
And let me guess, he then campaigned for square dancing to be taught in public schools.
Yeah, so according to Ford, square dancing would make this super valuable addition to physical education classes because, as he put it, it would teach children, quote, social training, courtesy, good citizenship, along with rhythm. And while you could probably argue that there are better ways to teach that kind of stuff, plenty of schools agreed with Ford's way of thinking, and by 1928, nearly half of the schools in America had started teaching their students to square dance, which is a trend that's continued right up to today.
I mean, it's impressive just how widespread this was, how effective he was at getting this taught in schools. And I can't say I've ever been a fan of square dancing, but I like it even less now that I know it was basically foisted on us by a white supremacist, and it just doesn't feel like a good look.
Yeah, I mean, I've told other people about this before, but like the two worst sections of gym class for me in middle school were wrestling, when they would take all the boys and put them in the small gym, and you would line up around by your weight. And from lowest, so I was always like the second person. And then they would call out your name with another person, and you'd have to wrestle in the middle. And it was barbaric
and awful.
And then the other thing that I hated was square dancing. I was like, why can't we just play regular sports?
That's pretty bad.
Why does it have to be an exhibition? But, you know, when you look at the actual history of square dancing, it is pretty ironic that Ford viewed it as this sort of intrinsically white way to beat back the influence of Black and Jewish music, because, you know, the truth is that Black people played a huge role in the development of square dancing as we know it today.
But wait, though, isn't it rooted in European dances that the colonists brought over?
Yeah, I mean, that's true. Like a lot of the dance moves and terminology were adapted for the French, which is why you can go to a square dance today and hear them use words like promenade and do-si-do, which is actually a corruption of the French phrase back-to-back. But, you know, when white colonists were dancing these steps in the early days of America, it was enslaved African Americans who provided the music. And it's through these musicians that square dancing really gained one of its most recognizable features, having a performer call out the dance figures to the audience. And at the time, many white dancers memorized the steps, you know, with the help of private instructors. So there really wasn't a need to have the steps called out to them. But when enslaved Blacks began adapting these dance moves for themselves, they needed a way to keep track of the steps. So they started calling out the moves to one another. And eventually this call and response pattern, it was adapted by white dancers. And pretty soon it became a crucial part of square dancing tradition.
Well, it seems a little bit convenient of Henry Ford to overlook that bit of history. But all right, well, let's stick with the seedier side of dance for just a minute and take a look at a few other dance-related controversies that have come up over the years. But before we do that, let's take a quick break. You're listening to Part-Time Genius, and we're talking about the surprising histories and controversies behind some of the world's most famous dance moves. So, Mango, you remember back in the early 90s when Madonna had that hit song called Vogue? You remember Madonna?
Yeah, I've heard of Madonna. It feels like everyone was striking a pose back then. I remember the video had all those, like, hand movements and fancy twirls, and it's still probably one of her most famous dances.
Oh, it definitely is. And, you know, it's interesting because the popularity doesn't sit well with some people, because while Madonna typically gets credit for the song and the dance, she actually didn't come up with the moves herself. And, you know, by most accounts, Vogue was invented in Harlem in the 1980s, and it was first danced by these Black drag queens that were in the LGBTQ club scene. And these drag queens were inspired by the glamorous women that they might see on Fifth Avenue, as you know, as well as like fashion magazines. You think of Vogue, of course, which is where the dance gets its name. Mm-hmm. But Vogue was more than just a series of these elaborate hand movements and runway model poses and things like that. I mean, these drag queens were actually using it as a storytelling device. And so they'd get up on stage and act out these little scenes, and they'd use their hands to show how they'd gotten dressed in drag, or maybe how they'd applied makeup or teased their hair. And so the net result was really this string of poses that was often very revealing and very personal about how a performer was thinking about themselves and how they might live their life, I guess.
Which is pretty awesome. And I do know a little bit about that, like, Harlem ballroom scene and the dance clubs where this came out of. But, you know, how does Madonna fit into all of this?
Well, supposedly she was introduced to Vogue by some friends who happened to be members of the drag community at the time. And this was sometime in the late 80s. And the singer really fell in love with the moves and wanted to showcase them in a song on her next album. And of course, she did this. And, you know, while Madonna likely saw this exposure is somewhat of a gift to the voguing community, there were lots of people who didn't see it that way. I mean, they believed Madonna was co-opting their dance and their experience and was doing all of this really for her own commercial gain.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the arguments there. But honestly, whether it's fair or not, Madonna is definitely the person who comes to mind when most of us think about voguing. And it makes sense that the drag community would bristle at having this straight white pop star become the symbol of something they came up with.
Yeah, and as one drag scene veteran put it, you know, Madonna took, quote, a very specifically queer, transgendered, Latino, and African-American phenomenon and totally erased that context. She was taking in tons of money, while the queen who actually taught her how to vogue sat in the club, strung out, depressed, and broke.
Yeah, and like a lot of these things, there really are two sides to this, right? Like, if you think back to the dancers in that Vogue video, it seems like Madonna was pretty good about representation in it.
Well, she definitely brought a few people from the Vogue scene along for the ride, and not just in the video, but also on the tour she did for the album. So there's no doubt she ended up benefiting some of the people who originated the dance. And like you said, it's always a little bit tricky. And the real question is whether that's enough to absolve her of what many people saw as kind of a form of cultural appropriation.
Well, I mean, I do think she deserves some points for taking this decidedly queer art form and giving it mainstream exposure in America. If nothing else, like, that had to mean a lot to these people in these underserved and underrepresented communities.
Yeah, and, you know, to go to bat for Madonna for a little bit here, you know, if you think about this, she's been a friend to the LGBTQ community for decades now, and she's employed a ton of gay dancers and instructors over the years and become a close friend and ally to many of them. And, you know, she spearheaded fundraisers and awareness campaigns to help combat the AIDS epidemic. And this was at a time when neither the government nor really the public at large were doing that much else to help with the problem. So, You know, even if we do take her to task for co-opting the Vogue, it's worth remembering that she's also given back to these communities where she drew so much of that creative inspiration.
Well, I want to switch gears a little and tell you about the time Serena Williams drew heat for borrowing some controversial dance moves of her own. And this was back during the 2012 Olympics, right after her gold medal singles victory against Maria Sharapova.
I remember this, actually. She did the, it's called the Sea Walk, right?
That's right. And this was a big deal for some people because the C in the name actually stands for Crip. And of course, the Crips are a pretty notorious gang that grew out of LA County.
You know, I knew that was the name, but I've always been a little hazy on the association. Like, is the dance really connected to the gang, or is this more of an urban legend kind of thing?
No, there's definitely a connection. So supposedly the gang invented the dance about 40 years ago in Compton, and it was actually a way for them to disrespect their rival gang, the Bloods. So the Crips would spell out the other gang's name on the sidewalk, you know, in chalk or something, and then they'd cross it out by using the dance to spell out their own name with their feet.
But I mean, that was a long time ago, right? Like, Isn't the Seawalk pretty divorced from the gang ties by now?
Yeah, I mean, the connection was tough to shake for a while. And in the early 2000s, the dance was even banned from schools in certain areas. But since then, a ton of performers have used the dance without issues, including everyone from Snoop Dogg to Justin Timberlake. Like, a couple other dancers have spun out the Seawalk, too. Like, there's the Clown Walk and the Crown Walk. And actually, some people maintain that Serena was really doing one of those after her win anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it always seemed like the blowback she got was a little more about the fact that she was celebrating it all rather than maybe like the specific dance that she did. And it does feel like a bit of a double standard because she's a black female. And I mean, if Justin Timberlake can get away with doing it, I feel like she should be able to as well.
So there's actually another reason why I think Serena's dance should get a pass. And a lot of people don't know this, but the Williams sisters used to have a half-sister named Yatunda Price. And tragically, back in 2003, Price was shot and killed by an active member of the Southside Crips gang. So, you know, when you consider that, if Serena feels like the dance step is far enough removed from gang violence for, you know, for her to feel comfortable doing it, then really, who are we to argue with her?
Yeah, that's a good point. Pretty compelling. But, you know, one thing I noticed while digging into dance history is that dances often fall in and out of favor over time, and they never really stay fixed. I mean, they're kind of always evolving and may take on new shades of meaning as different generations and cultures kind of put their own spin on them.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And the example I always think of is capoeira. Like, is it a dance or a martial art? Is it Brazilian or is it African? Like, the truth is somewhere in the middle, because over the years, capoeira has been all of these things and more to so many different people.
Oh, that is definitely something I feel like we should talk about. But before we get to that, let's take one more quick break. Okay, Mango, so give us some more background on capoeira, because I don't think it's an art form that a lot of people know that much about. And it's kind of like the precursor to breakdancing, though, isn't it?
So that breakdancing connection is actually a whole can of worms that I'll get into in a minute. But yeah, on the surface, the two practices do have a lot in common, like the footwork, the upside down movements, the way the performers interact with the ground. Like, it's all pretty similar. But while breaking had this pretty definitive start in the Bronx during the late 70s, capoeira's history is a little hazier. So what we do know for sure is that capoeira was developed in Brazil by enslaved Africans sometime between the 1500s and the 1800s. And as you might remember, Brazil was a colony of Portugal for that 300-year span. And during that time, an estimated 4 million enslaved people were brought across the Atlantic to Brazil. The majority were forced to work in gold and diamond mines or in the country's vast sugarcane fields, but some managed to escape inland and hide out in the rainforests, and some historians think that that's where capoeira got its start. So over time, the theory is that these escaped Africans were able to find each other, and as they did, they began to form these independent communities. It was rooted in expressions of African culture, and capoeira is thought to be one of those expressions, like a form of defense that relies on these rhythmic movements to disarm and confuse and ultimately defeat an opponent.
All right, I see. So the dance elements are really kind of meant as a way to distract an opponent or throw them off balance or something?
So that's definitely one theory. There's another theory that capoeira emerged before the Africans escaped, and that to hide this new form of fighting from the slave masters, they started camouflaging it as a dance. And that way they could train for potential revolt right out in the open. And if you go by this theory, it also explains why instruments were later added to capoeira. I mean, what better way to complete this dance disguise than by adding music to the mix?
Yeah, and you know, it starts to make sense what you were talking about before with capoeira being really kind of morphed to fit the needs of different people, different time periods. But I do want to go back to that breakdancing connection, though, because, you know, I know capoeira made its way stateside in the 1970s, and that was around the time that, you know, breakdancers were getting started. But with all the similarities that you mentioned, it feels like there's got to be some kind of connection, though, right?
Well, I mean, a lot of people think so. Actually, do you remember this? When we used to go for hip-hop shows at the Cat's Cradle, sometimes there'd be a group of breakdancers and a group of capoeira enthusiasts, and they'd kind of dance off. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was.
But, you know, you'd assume they're sort of linked in some greater way, but I really couldn't find anything to support the idea. And like you said, capoeira came to the U.S. in the mid-70s, and that was largely thanks to two veteran practitioners who started touring the country and teaching the techniques at various colleges. But there doesn't seem to be much, if any, evidence of overlap between capoeira and the earliest breakdancers. And instead, most breakers will actually tell you that they took their early moves from kung fu movies more than anything else. But of course, even if capoeira didn't give birth to breakdancing, it's safe to say that both practices have inspired each other in the time since.
Well, and besides that, I mean, capoeira and breakdancing are still both rooted in African tradition. So even if they did develop centuries and thousands of miles apart, I mean, maybe their connection is less like a parent and child and more like that of maybe two distant cousins or something.
Yeah, definitely. Like, origins aside, these are two forms of expression that definitely have a lot in common.
All right. Well, I know we're running out of time here, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention a milestone in dance history that I was just reading about this week, because as it turns out, this year is actually the 35th anniversary of Michael Jackson's moonwalk. Can you believe it's been that long, Mango?
I mean, I can't, but you do know that the moonwalk is like way older than that, right?
Well, I said it was the 35th anniversary of Michael Jackson's moonwalk, not the first ever moonwalk, but while we're talking about that, refresh my memory, though. Like, who beat MJ to the punch on this one?
So there are more people than I'd remembered. David Bowie did his own take on the move during his 1973 tour. Back in the 50s, both Cab Calloway and Bill Bailey included moonwalks in their performances. And probably the earliest case I've heard of is actually that famous French mime, Marceau Marceau. And he actually had this act in the 40s called Walking in the Wind, where he would pretend to brace himself against this imaginary wind. And so he would act like he was struggling against the wind. And as he did this, he would slide backwards. But the interesting thing about him is that he was actually friends with Michael Jackson for decades. Huh. And Jackson said multiple times that the mime's work had this huge influence on his performance style.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, Jackson was probably influenced by each of those performers in one way or another. But you know, from what I've read, it actually looks like MJ patterned this moonwalk after these two breakdancers that he'd seen on an episode of Soul Train. And this was a few years before all of this. And their names were Jerron Casper Candidate and Cooley Jackson, no relation here. And the story goes that MJ remembered their performance and wound up arranging a meeting with the men while he was prepping for his big Motown special. Now, this was in 1983. And so the guys taught them this backslide move, and Jackson practiced it until he had it down pat. And he wanted to debut this moonwalk during the Motown special, and this was a very strategic move on his part. So at the time, Michael had already released two solo albums, but he wasn't completely out of the shadow of the Jackson 5. And in fact, the bulk of his performance during the special was devoted to this Jackson 5 reunion of sorts. But Michael only agreed to appear at all because he was able to convince the producer to let him do this solo performance. And he wanted to do one especially of a non-Motown song. And the producer agrees to this. And so Jackson ends up performing Billie Jean on stage that night for a television audience of 34 million people.
Wow.
And so, you know, of course, you think about this. How did Jackson ensure the performance was a memorable one? Well, it was a few seconds of sliding backwards across the stage, and that did it.
Well, I mean, clearly it worked, and it's basically become his signature move.
Yeah, and crowds just ate it up. And I'd read that even Fred Astaire apparently called Jackson after the Motown performance to congratulate him. And huh. The move was a game changer for Jackson's career and the world of dance, and it seemed like everybody knew it. And of course, one of the drawbacks to that is that everybody then tried to replicate the move themselves, and usually very unsuccessfully.
You know what's funny is that I've actually heard that Jackson's pet chimpanzee, Bubbles, got pretty good at the moonwalk.
Really?
Which is way more than I could say. I feel like the Arch Deluxe is probably more my speed.
Well, I'm sure Tristan will teach it to you anytime you want. But in the meantime, though, I think there are a few more dance moves that we haven't gotten to yet. So what do you say we slip on our dancing shoes and bust out a couple of quick moves in the Fact Off?
Definitely.
All right, well, earlier this year, New Orleans was the home to a revival of this 1894 show called Tabasco, a burlesque opera. And yes, it is that Tabasco. So there's a conductor named Paul Moffrey, and he stumbled into this program for the old show while doing some research on the history of New Orleans music. Now, the opera is about this Irish traveler who gets lost at sea, and he ends up landing in Morocco and is forced to become a chef for this military officer there. Now, the military officer there happens to love spicy food, and so in his effort to come up with just the right dish for him, Tabasco sauce comes to the rescue. Now, I had no idea that Tabasco had been around that long, but it's apparently celebrating its 150th anniversary this year.
Oh, wow.
So back to this original performance back in 1894, the Louisiana-based company Tabasco, they actually agreed to underwrite part of the cost of the show if they would give out tiny bottles of the stuff at these performances when it debuted in Boston. And it turns out the show had a pretty good run across a bunch of U.S. cities, but they ran into some legal battles over the use of the product and the kind of the rights around the show. And so the show closed down and it almost disappeared completely until Moffrey discovered it more than 100 years later.
Well, so I know we've talked about prison reform and unique prisons in previous episodes, but there's one I don't think we talked about, and that's Iwahig Prison and Penal Farm in the Philippines. So this is where inmates dance with and for tourists. And the place sprawls over 64,000 acres, and the inmates pretty much move freely across it. Tourists visit, and they stop by the recreation center to see 10 to 20 inmates perform multiple songs. And then the tourists stick around to check out and purchase various crafts the inmates have made. And it's definitely unlike any prison you'd find in the States.
Yeah, I haven't heard of anything like that. That's very interesting. Well, we couldn't do an episode on dances without covering the chicken dance. You had to know this one is coming at some point. And it turns out it was kind of named this by accident. So the melody for the song was written more than 60 years ago, and it was written by this Swiss musician named Werner Thomas. Now, Thomas used to make a living by playing accordion at these various holiday resorts in Switzerland. And as he came up with the melody, he gradually began putting dance moves to it. But weirdly, the moves weren't inspired by chickens, but by skiers, which sounds a little bit surprising. But many of the motions of skiers flying down these mountains there really reminded Thomas of different birds. And so he started to put some of these motions into a dance that they started to call Dance Little Bird. So how did it become the chicken dance? Well, it's tough to say, but it may have something to do with this Oktoberfest celebration that actually happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, back in 1981. There was a German band there that decided to play the song. And the organizers of the event, I guess they were super excited about this song for some reason, but they thought it would be fun to find a costume to go along with the dance. And the best thing they could find was a chicken suit that a local TV station had. And so, of course, the rest is history.
That is amazing. I feel embarrassed that I didn't look up a chicken dance fact. You know,
yep.
That's so good.
Beat you to it.
So back in the late 20s and early 30s, a certain type of dance hall started popping up in big cities like Chicago and New York City. And these were dance halls where men could dance with hired women dancers for 10 cents a song. And by the early 30s, there were over 100 of these so-called taxi dance halls in New York City. Something like 50,000 men would visit these each week. And
oh, wow.
Thanks to this sociologist named Paul G. Cressy, we know some of the lingo and history, and that's how it's been preserved. So the dancers were often referred to as nickel hoppers, since they usually made half of the 10 cents the men would pay. And weirdly, the trend stuck around until the mid-1900s. But that's when law enforcement began cracking down on things like prostitution, mob activities, and all of that stuff that had been sort of associated with these dance halls.
Okay. All right, well, recent studies have shown the benefits of dancing for Parkinson's disease or for the treatment of Parkinson's disease. And in fact, several studies have looked at this and they found that dancing helps really on two fronts. Now, the first is more on the physical side, where this rhythmic movement from dancing can actually help reduce the motor control difficulties that are often accompanied by Parkinson's. And the relief isn't necessarily immediate, but over time, it does seem to help train the brain and the body for, you know, more fluid motion. And not surprisingly, the other major benefit of dancing for those with Parkinson's is reducing some of that social isolation that many of the patients often experience. And as one dance instructor put it, their mood changes within a few minutes of being there. They're no longer patients, but dance students.
Well, speaking of dance classes, back in 2011, this nearly 40-story mall in Seoul, South Korea started shaking, and it did so for nearly 10 minutes. And the weird events caused this two-day evacuation and, of course, this investigation. And you won't believe what caused it, or maybe you will. It turns out that a couple dozen middle-aged people in a Taibo class started dancing to The Power by the band The Snap.
Yeah.
And you know the song. It's like,
I've got the power.
So the investigation revealed that it wasn't the weight of the people dancing. It was just their rhythm. And as Professor Chong Lan of Dankook University explained, quote, "It just happens to be that the vibration set up by the Taibo coincided with a resonance frequency unique to the building."
Wow, there is no way to top that. And actually, the fact that Tristan is now out of his chair doing some of his own Taibo moves, I mean, this is a total blowout. I'm going to have to give you today's trophy, Mango.
Thank you so much, Will.
And thank you guys for listening. We'd love to hear your great dance stories or dance facts. You can always email those to parttimegenius@howstuffworks.com or hit us up on Facebook or Twitter. But as always, thanks so much for listening. Thanks again for listening. Part-Time Genius is a production of How Stuff Works and wouldn't be possible without several brilliant people who do the important things we couldn't even begin to understand.
Tristan McNeil does the editing thing.
Noel Brown made the theme song and does the mixy-mixy sound thing.
Gary Rowland does the exec producer thing.
Gabe Luzier is our lead researcher with support from the research army, including Austin Thompson, Nolan Brown, and Lucas Adams.
And Eves Jeffcoat gets the show to your ears. Good job, Eves.
If you like what you heard, we hope you'll subscribe. And if you really, really like what you've heard, maybe you could leave a good review for us.
Did we forget Jason?
Jason who?